lined even when sleeper cells were activated to kill Ukrainian military intelligence officers in 2017, a former employee of the current Russian president on the streets of Washington, D.C. in 2015, and almost one person a year in Great Britain since the beginning of the decade. Unlike traditional intelligence officers, illegals lived a complete lie. Instead of operating under a semi-legitimate cover for status position, usually a job at the embassy or consulate, illegals had to enter a nation with little aid from their own government and blend into their new country. Alexander knew he would have been a brilliant illegal because he had mastered the lie. He could do it without the slightest hint of remorse. As was his father's wish, he had run illegals at postings across the world, and his success had driven him rapidly up the ranks of directorate S, eventually landing him back in Russia in a position to pass intelligence to the family business. Alexander could create virtually bulletproof false identities, as well as produce legitimate Russian Federation passports to match them. For someone trying to smuggle a person across international borders, Alexander Zharkov could work magic. A posting in the intelligence world might seem like a strange place for the son of a mafia boss, but in Russia, as Alexander knew, there was a long history of associations between the government and organized crime that predated their Sicilian counterparts by almost a century. From the Tsars to Stalinist Russia through the waning days of the Soviet Union and into the heyday after the fall, the Red Mafia was embedded in almost all facets of state affairs. The Bratva was not an outside criminal threat, but rather part of the government itself. When Stalin betrayed his criminal ties during the Great Purge, he inadvertently created an even stronger organization that had survived and thrived to this day. What might raise eyebrows in other parts of the world was business as usual for the Russian Federation. Alexander was simply continuing the tradition. The director had what he described as a functional relationship with his mob boss father, but there was an underlying rift between them that went beyond the traditional father-son power struggle, a chasm that developed when Alexander was still a boy. Ivan had insisted that his eldest son pursue a career in the nation's intelligence services, a career that would surely pay dividends for his father's business interests. Alexander had sacrificed his entire adult life climbing the ladder of the SVR, a ladder that had led him through countless third-world hellholes, places where not too many questions were asked when a man went missing. Meanwhile, his two younger brothers lived the good life, chasing women, driving fast cars, and putting coke up their noses in Paris, London, New York, and Miami. His father promised him that in the long run he would be the Pakhan, and his brothers would be his lieutenants. Yet, year after year, his brothers rose in influence, building their own networks. Alexander knew that he was too valuable to his father in his current position to leave, and that his younger siblings at this point would not let him simply walk in and take what they now considered theirs. Alexander felt the pull born of a primal instinct from a time when people lacked the ability to reason, when they were no different from every other animal roaming the earth. Civilization was a more recent introduction to the evolution of the species. Despite that thin veneer, instinct still requires the young bull to exert his dominance over the herd. That time was approaching for the Zharkov line, and Alexander would soon make his move. Chapter 8. St. Petersburg, Russia. 700 kilometers to the northwest, Ivan Zharkov had left Oliver Gray in the suite, giving him a chance to bathe, rest, and recover from his travels. Prostitution was one of the Bratva's primary rackets, and the mafia boss had offered Gray a woman for the night. Upon Gray's refusal, Ivan had offered him a man. Gray graciously declined both, which caused some confusion on the part of his host. The embarrassment of Gray's one sexual encounter with a female was an experience that he did not wish to repeat. The vodka left Gray buzzing, but after a long bath in the room's extravagant tub, he felt almost human again. He was beginning to doze when a knock on the door sent a surge of adrenaline through his body. Wrapped in a bathrobe, he peered through the peephole and spied a small, bearded man carrying an attaché case. "Can I help you?"
"I am Lev, the tailor. Pachan sent me."
Gray breathed a sigh of relief and opened the door. He had half expected to see a tall American holding a suppressed pistol instead of the small, pot-bellied man impeccably dressed in a three-piece suit. The tailor walked into the room without shaking Gray's hand and began to unpack the tools of his trade. Lev insisted that Gray remove the robe and began taking measurements with a physician's disinterest in his stark nudity. Each measurement was entered into a small notebook with a small stub of a pencil. Gray was embarrassed and spoke nervously as the man worked, ignoring his attempts at conversation as though they didn't speak the same language.
"Put on your robe. We need to pick fabrics," Lev said as he snapped the small notebook shut and wrapped it with a thick rubber band.
He spread books of swatches across the bed and motioned for Gray to examine them.
"Mr. Zharkov has generously paid for 3 suits and 5 shirts. I will make you more if you choose, but they will come from your own pocket."
Gray spent close to an hour narrowing his choices, ultimately picking a brown tweed, a charcoal window pane, and a blue chalk line. He didn't want to look like another one of Zharkov's security men. He chose plain, solid shirts that would keep his life simple. He knew better than to tackle the daily challenge of matching his clothes.
"I do not make shoes or ties. For those items, you should go to the passage on Nevsky Prospect. It is not far."
The man looked at the small gold watch on his wrist.
"These items will be ready in 2 days.
He quickly packed his bag, returned his black Homburg to his head, and walked swiftly out the door. It was late afternoon when Gray stepped out of the hotel and began a leisurely half-hour walk toward the city's upscale shopping district. "You are safe here, Oliver. There is no need to worry." Though he had only been to St. Petersburg a handful of times, always on CIA business, he felt strangely at home here. He absorbed the splendor of St. Petersburg as he wound his way through the streets, admiring the intricate Baroque and neoclassical architecture. His path took him on to the Nevsky Prospect and across the narrow Fontanka River via the Anikhov Bridge. He took a small detour to walk the grounds of the Alexandrinsky Theater, filled with mothers watching their bundled-up children playing in the park. Taking a seat on a bench at the edge of the Mikhailovsky Garden, he packed his pipe and tried to relax. The city was alive. It was hard to believe. There was a time, not that long ago, when Russia's cultural capital was almost destroyed by the Axis powers in World War II, back when it went by the name Leningrad. Gray seemed to remember that snipers were somehow associated with the siege. Or was that Stalingrad? The thought of snipers caused Gray to abruptly move from his bench and continue toward his destination. He looked up at the surrounding buildings, half expecting to see James Reese behind a scope. The analyst in him attempted to banish the notion. "Reese could never find me here. I am now protected by the Bratva." Gray crossed the street and walked the remaining block to the passage, an upscale shopping arcade that dated back to the 1840s. As he strolled through the long building, all marble and plaster, peering into the hand-painted plate-glass windows of the various shops, Gray felt transported to a different era. The building was a striking example of Russian prominence with its intricate tile floor, detailed dentil interior trim, and vaulted glass ceiling. Most of the customers displayed noticeable signs of wealth, oversized ornate watches for the men and long furs, high-end handbags, and diamonds for the women. Everyone chatted on iPhones as they shopped. The proceeds of Russia's raw materials, oil, natural gas, gold, copper, and magnesium, extracted by tough, filthy men who drank hard and died young, were converted by the nation's elite into hard currency that flowed through luxury arteries such as this one. Gray's family had always been at the base of this class pyramid, but he was working his way up. He took his time shopping, carefully selecting the ties, socks, underwear, and t-shirts that would comprise his new wardrobe. He completed the ensemble with a frightfully expensive pair of shoes that put a significant dent in his stack of euros. Each vendor made change in rubles, allowing him to accumulate local currency without having to deal with the formality of banks. He found a barbershop and spent some of his new money on a haircut and a beard trim. The heavily tattooed staff were all young men who obviously spent a great deal of time and effort emulating the appearance of American hipsters. It seemed that one could not escape the West's cultural poison even in Mother Russia. Two men lounged on the black pleather couch in the corner, playing a soccer video game on a large LCD television monitor that hung on the exposed brick wall. Gray spoke little, but listened intently, trying to gather as much practical knowledge as possible about his new home. He had done his best to enjoy the day, but an annoying sensation that he couldn't seem to erase continually interrupted his contentment. The vodkas he downed with dinner did nothing to shake his feelings of impending doom. He stumbled more than once in his haste to return to the safety of his hotel, his eyes darting from shadow to shadow and rooftop to rooftop, the specter of James Reese, his constant companion. Chapter 9. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Reese cranked the powerful motor on his new cruiser and listened to it hum. He pulled out of the garage and gunned the motor as he turned up the steep grade, testing the vehicle's torque as it climbed. It responded instantly and flew up the gravel track, spitting rocks as it went. He crested the ridge and took it slowly down the switchbacks. No sense flipping his new ride on the first day. He hit the ranch's main road and turned in the direction of the refurbished barn that Rafe used as his workshop, a 20-minute trip by vehicle. The two friends had joined the Navy a year apart, taking separate paths until finally serving together in Ramadi, Iraq, at the height of the war. When their task unit lost two SEALs to a roadside bomb, Rafe went off the reservation, using their tactical HUMINT network to find the IED cell leader responsible, a man named Hakim al-Maliki. He then used that same network to deliver a package to the terrorist after a sanctioned raid to capture him was called off by higher authority. Al-Maliki was a CIA asset, and his value as a long-term penetration agent meant he was off-limits as a target. The device that sent al-Maliki to the afterlife contained a fertilizer-based main charge with commercial detonators from Pakistan, an IED profile common to Ramadi at the time. The CIA was furious, accusing Rafe of killing their prized asset and demanding he be prosecuted. The Navy had not been sure what to do and immediately launched an investigation. Reese was the only person who could identify Rafe as the bomber, and he refused to cooperate with investigators, causing no shortage of consternation between the Navy and the CIA, and between Reese and Rafe. Rafe didn't want to see Reese's reputation tarnished by investigations, and Reese wasn't about to be a witness against his blood brother. Due in no small part to his friend's refusal to provide any useful information to investigators, and out of concern for the damage it could do if the facts of the case became public, Rafe was eventually cleared of the accusation. The CIA, protecting an insurgent responsible for blowing up members of the U.S. military, long-term penetration agent or not, would not play well in the court of public opinion. Wasn't the job of SEALs to kill terrorists? Rafe was removed from theater and assigned to the Naval Special Warfare Cold Weather Warfare Detachment on Kodiak Island in Alaska. There he put his ample outdoor skills to use, training new SEALs to survive and thrive in the austere climate of the North. It was a perfect fit for the adopted son of Montana, but as an officer, he couldn't stay in the job indefinitely. He'd grown tired of watching men and women come home from endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, physically and emotionally broken. It was time to move on. When he received orders to move into a staff role down in Coronado, he dropped his papers and resigned his commission. He first took a job in finance, throwing himself into it with the same zeal with which he had attacked all of life's challenges, but he felt suffocated by life in Manhattan. Rafe was rushing to the office one day when he received a text message telling him that his old team chief at Redacted had shot himself in the heart. He'd left a suicide note apologizing to his wife and children and asking that his brain be used to study the effects of traumatic brain injury and PTSD. After 2 weeks in Virginia Beach assisting the family and attending the memorial and funeral, Rafe decided it was time to go home. As Rafe made the long drive from New York to western Montana, his mind went to work. He needed to find a way to help transition his former teammates into life beyond the fight, a bridge to the next chapter in life. He couldn't just hand them a suit and help them write a resume. They needed to find purpose again. Rafe also examined his own life. A natural loner who thrived in the solitude of the outdoors, Rafe still knew something was missing. Anika Thornton had been his on-again, off-again girlfriend since high school. Their fathers were close friends and adjoining landowners in many of their real estate holdings. It had been Anika's father, Tim, who had encouraged Jonathan Hastings to diversify his cattle earnings into Montana real estate. That move had proven to be vastly more lucrative than ranching. While Rafe chose to attend the University of Montana in Missoula, Anika was accepted to Yale and they drifted apart. When Rafe was based in Virginia Beach and she was in graduate school at Wharton in Philadelphia, their relationship rekindled, and Rafe had nearly proposed. When he received word that he'd earned a coveted slot at Green Team, his personal life was forced to the back burner. Anika took a job in San Francisco, and soon after that, 9/11 hit. Rafe's life was focused on his endless overseas deployments, and hers was spent making her own way in the business world. They kept in touch and reunited whenever their geographic paths crossed. When it came time for her father, Tim Thorne Thornton, to pull back on the reins of life and spend some time away from the business, he was finally able to convince Anika to return to Montana. She was serving as the chief operating officer of a Dallas-based energy firm and on a path to be the company's first female CEO. She had proven to herself and everyone else that she could be successful on her own. No one would doubt her ability to serve as president of the family's vast petroleum and real estate empire. The two childhood sweethearts were finally back in Big Sky Country. The wedding of Tim Thornton's only daughter could have been a lavish affair, the formal joining of two families who were some of Montana's largest and wealthiest landowners. Instead, they opted for more subdued nuptials at Rafe's uncle's hunting operation in Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique. When the newlyweds returned from a 3-week honeymoon that took them across South Africa from Cape Town to a private game reserve in the Sabi Sands, Rafe went to work building the next chapter in his life. Both the Hastings and Thornton families had been leasing their land to hunting outfitters for years, and some had been more dedicated than others when it came to managing the natural resources. Rafe built a plan that would sustainably manage the ranch's wildlife while providing a path forward for his fellow Special Operations veterans. He consolidated all of the leases into a single outfitting business that handled everything from the booking of the clients to the processing and shipping of the meat. There were a surprising number of